clippings for 20 years of a baby face Neil Armstrong and walking in his moon suit. Well, the moon, as I've said, is a pretty interesting subject, we've decided, and today in Hardly News we'll be looking at some of the scientific interest in it anyway. And we have Andrew Rennie from the Australian Space Association and Mark Blair, a rocket maker, in the studio to talk about some of the space projects that Australians have been involved in. But we're not ignoring the other aspect of the moon either, that of its importance in myth and religion and religious life. And Lewin Dunan will be here to discuss that at about 10 to 10 this morning. And you're listening to Hardly News, back on deck now.
To get up on your feet, put your braces together and your boots on your feet, and give me some of that old moon stomping. Get ready. We got 3 million miles to reach on the moon, so let's start getting happy now. Ready? Yeah, 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 yeah. On the moon, fellas, we gotta make sure that everything is thick and strong. All right, you gotta make sure you shine your boots, brush your teeth, because the man on the moon looking different from man on the earth. That's what I say, boy. Now remember, I'm your boss, Skinner speaking. My name is Caleb.
All right,
right. And remember, I'm the boss. You can see. Look on my foot, or my feet, whatever you want to call it. You can see I've got the biggest boot. That's all right. Now, when I say sing, I want everybody to get in the groove and start singing, because we're on the moon. Ready? One time. Ready? Here we go. One down. Now, we want to make sure when we get up in there, we got the moon in front of us. Now, when we finish this, we ain't got no problem on the moon, so we gotta wait till we get back to the earth and have a drink. Okay?
Yeah.
All right. Now, we want to make sure that everybody's still in the groove when we get back, so let's start singing one more time. Ready?
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Well, no prizes for guessing what that one was. It was the Skinhead Moon Stomp.
The most imposing object on Earth today, the most talked about thing, the most dreaded, and in turn the most promising of all earthly and man-made devices, is the rocket. To some, it is an instrument of war whose foreboding shadow of fear blankets the Earth. It occupies a place in the minds of all thinking men of every race and creed, in every country. Indeed, the rocket is an instrument of war, for circumstance has dictated it to be. It stands sentinel for our way of life, a symbol of strength guarding the peace. It is standing near the cornfields of Iowa, scant steps from the beaches of Florida, in the deserts of Africa, amid the Alps, and in northern snow, It is waiting beneath the sea in giant submarines and flies eternal under wings of great bombers. It is not a terrible thing, but a thing of great beauty, a symbol of protection to all men who are free, and a symbol of hope to all who dream of being. It stands like a giant finger of warning to all who would seek our destruction, to leave us alone.
And, well, very, very strict warning there, leave us alone. And it's 11 minutes past nine on Hardly News. Our first guest this morning is rocket builder Mark Blair. Mark is a fourth-year mechanical engineering student at Monash University. Early this year at Pakapanyol Army Base, he launched a rocket which he had designed and built. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
How did your rocket compare to, say, the Apollo series?
Well, it's very much smaller. This rocket was about 2.6 metres long. The Apollo 11 rocket that took off with Neil Armstrong on board was 111 metres tall.
So you weren't planning to go aboard?
No, no one was planning to go on board.
So, well, your smallish rocket, tell me the features. Did it look the same shape as the more conventional rocket, or the one we imagine?
Yes, it had a conventional rocket shape. It was a cylindrical body, had a combustion chamber at the bottom and a nose cone at the top.
What was so special about it? How was it fueled, for instance?
It was fueled by liquid propellants, the same as the moon rockets, although different propellants. It had 130 kilograms of thrust and burned for 7 seconds, so we estimated it went to about 3 kilometres.
Now, what was the point of that?
It was basically to see if we could actually build one. A lot of people associate rocketry with high technology, and it was just a challenge to be able to build a rocket of this type.
All right. Well, having built the rocket and launched it, have you satisfied your obsession with proving a point about the ability of the ordinary person to construct a rocket, or are you going to keep going?
I'm going to keep going, definitely. It was only a catalyst to spark more interest in rocketry, so I'm going on now with a bigger one.
When you were actually building it, I imagine there would have been a few expensive materials involved. I mean, you can't just throw it together out of old jam tins, can you?
No, you need some special materials, but thankfully I got a lot of sponsors for the project and we managed to proceed.
What kind of assistance did you get?
Well, materials donations, machine shop assistance from various people, and a lot of donations made the first one possible. We're going on with another rocket this year, and we're getting even bigger sponsors. It's a lot bigger, a lot more expensive, and we're getting a lot more interest being shown for this second one.
Right, now, as I said before, the rocket that you just made was launched at Pakapanyol. Can you describe the success or failure of that event?
The propulsion, i.e. the rocket, went very well. Our recovery system, the parachute, failed to operate successfully.
You made that parachute yourself, didn't you?
We made the parachute and the release mechanism, and we obviously underestimated the forces involved, and it got ripped off as it was going up.
Did you recover all the bits?
We recovered none of the bits. We couldn't find anything once it went up into the cloud layer, and we never saw it again.
But you were monitoring the event with telemetry, weren't you?
Yes, we were receiving a height signal coming down from the rocket through a transmitter, and we tracked it up to 1 kilometre in altitude. From there, we lost the signal, and despite numerous searches of the range, we never found either any of the bits.
That's amazing. So the bits and pieces you were able to monitor was sufficient for you to say that the event was successful?
Yes, definitely. The propulsion system of the rocket was the main target of the project, and it worked very well.
It seems to me that it would be maybe a better system to have a rocket that didn't need to cart all its fuel with it.
That would be good, it's just impossible. All rockets have to carry the fuel with them.
And You're at Monash as a mechanical engineering student. Does that mean that you get assistance from the university, or you're also a member of the Space Association? Who's showing the greater interest?
Oh, a bit of both. They're getting interest through Monash. I'm a student there, and I'm doing a fourth-year project with them for the second rocket. It's an official project. We're getting outside sponsors because the university doesn't have enough money to pay for the rocket. The Space Association's also showing interest. There are various members that have interests in rocketry, and I'm getting assistance from them as well.
What was your first rocket like?
Well, in what way?
Well, how does it compare? The second one was
Oh, the first one was a small one. That was just a test rocket. The next one we're building will go to about 35 kilometres in altitude. It'll be 6 metres long, have 1,000 kilograms of thrust. So it's an order of magnitude bigger than the previous one.
And another Pakapanyol launch?
Definitely not. Pakapanyol is way too small for a launch, to launch something up to 35 kilometres.
Woomera?
We're aiming for Woomera, yes. We've been in contact with the Defence Department about Woomera, and they've sent us information sheets, and we have to get back to them with more information. But we're hoping for a launch there in December.
I don't understand where you go to for your expertise if there's not a great deal of work going on in Australia for this. I mean, just who's going to be prepared? Because it hasn't been done, how come people are sort of prepared to go into it? Do they go in blind?
Now, they go in for the interest's sake. The sponsors, especially, it's a very novel concept and very few people have done it before in Australia. And we've also approached people behind the Cape York Spaceport who are actually sponsoring the project. And that's been very helpful to us.
All right. Well, just to wind up, what's your ambition? Are you personally wanting to work somewhere, say, at Cape York or Woomera? Or?
I'd like to work at Cape York once it gets going and doing commercial launches up there. I'd very much like to get into the aerospace industry.
Okay, anyone who's interested in finding out more or lending their knowledge about rockets, how do they contact you, Mark?
Oh, they can contact me on 546-7782 or through Monash University Mechanical Engineering Department.
Right, that's Mark Blair, rocket builder, and you're listening to Hardly News, and it's 16 minutes past nine.
Would you like to ride in my rocket to the moon?
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
Would you like to ride in my rocket to the moon?
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
Give me your answer and we'll be leaving soon.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
You'll have to hold tight, baby, while I go in my spin.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr.
Yes,
moon.
Yes, hold tight, baby, while I go in my spin.
Rocket to the moon, rocket,
love the new world that I'm gonna take you in.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
We'll take off for a star and the moon is not too far.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
We'll take off for a star and the moon is not too far.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
We'll ride and glide and be so satisfied.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
Stand by, stand by. The rocket is ready to fly. Happy that you're my girl when we fly through the sky and go out of this world. Well, we rip it and we'll dip it
on the rocket to the moon.
We'll rip it and we'll dip it
on the rocket to the moon.
We'll flip it and we'll whip it
on the rocket to the moon.
We'll ride and glide and feel so satisfied. On the trip we'll be soon on my rocket to the moon.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
Are we asking for? Is a little cash, just a little bit. Your cash, just a little bit. Your cash, just a little bit.
See ya.
Just a little bit. Your cash, just a little bit.
My name is Colleen Hartland and I have been asked as chairperson of 3CR to thank the many people who gave to our radiothon. The station greatly appreciates your donations, especially in these hard economic times. Please send your money to P.O. Box 1277 Collingwood, postcode 3066. Thank you very much.
See ya. See ya. See ya. See ya. See ya. Are you planning a pregnancy? Pacific Chemcor wish to announce our new range of extraterrestrial birthing facilities. Book now for a place in our Sea of Tranquility Moonbirth Center, complete with solar-paneled aquatic complex and the full range of state-of-the-art in vitro. Gentle postnatal exercise conducted by our highly qualified lunar physio team and confidential new parent counseling. You're gravity-free in our low-light lunar Laboyer birthing suites. In space, no one can hear you scream. Ah. Thank you, Chemcor.
And it's 21 minutes past nine, and as we said, we've got a couple of people from the Space Association in the studio with us, Andrew Rennie and Mark Blair. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Well, you've got an exhibition at the CAE buildings on Sunday, I understand. Can you give us an outline of that event?
Yes, that's right. From about 1 o'clock in the afternoon at 256 Flinders Street at the Council for Adult Education Seminar Centre, we're going to be celebrating the moon landing 20 years ago, and we're going to be showing movies of that event, slides, and we're going to have talks by expert speakers, we're going to have videos, posters. We're going to have some fabric material from an actual Apollo spacesuit. We're going to have lots of other space memorabilia there as well.
You were saying before that the fabric of the spacesuit is a real draw card, and people sort of might rush in expecting to see a complete spacesuit. But I noticed that it's just one of those, what do you call it? It's like a fabric catalogue, isn't it?
It's like the sample catalogues you'll find in a material shop. A large department store where you flick through and you can see the different layers that the spacesuit's made up of. It's made up of about nearly 10 layers of fabric.
Right, so you've brought the sample in. Are people going to be able to touch it?
Oh, yes.
That'll
yes.
be the compulsion, of course.
Oh, yes, they'll be able to look at it and be quite amazed at the fact it's got layers of plastic, it's got layers of woven, aluminised material, it's got fireproof material in it, and it's got almost just like cotton as well.
So is there some explanation of the reason behind all that along with it in the exhibition?
Yes, there is. It has a very hard protective outer layer in case they're up against rocks and other projections so it doesn't get punctured. It needs airtight seals and it needs thermal insulation because they were walking on rocks, for example, which were very, very hot under the sun, but also going into shady areas where the temperature may be as low as 150 below zero.
How long has it taken to mount the exhibition?
We've been working on it for some months. We've been thinking about it for over a year, and it's taken quite a bit of time to get the venue booked out and to assemble the videotapes and things and the speakers and the slides and book the films.
It's billed as Relive the Moon Landing. Is it totally devoted to that event 20 years ago, or does it look at space exploration since?
It looks at space as well, in general. We're going to be looking also at Voyager, because we're only a month away from the Voyager 2 encounter with Neptune, and so we'll be looking at that as well. But the main focus is on Apollo, but we'll be looking at the space shuttle and anything else to do with space as well.
Well, the last feat belonging to Gene Cernan and Jack Smith on Apollo 17 15 years ago, how come there's been no human landing since that time? That's 15 years ago. It seems to be a giant gap after the euphoria of the landing 20 years ago.
Yes, well, if you go back to what President Kennedy said, that he set the objective to land a man on the moon and return him to Earth by the end of the decade, that is the end of the 1960s. And with Apollo 11, they did that. They had done that. In fact, they'd brought two men on the moon and brought them back. So their later missions, Apollo 12, 14, 15, 16 and 17, eventually landing 12 people on the moon, more than met Kennedy's objective. There was talk of carrying on and building a space station right then, but Congress just didn't come up with the money. America lost the will. It was at time embroiled in the Vietnam War, and it's actually quite amazing that at the same time a country was fighting a war, a quite a major war, and at the same time was able to put people on the moon. And at that, with the accomplishment of that, America just lost the will to carry on in space. It did undertake the space shuttle program a bit later, but there was that long, long gap.
Well, what's their primary motivation, do you think? Is it extending a marketplace in terms of minerals and exploiting the minerals on the moon? Or is it scientific discovery? Is it just that the urge to achieve something that's not been done before, forging new frontiers? Or is it some kind of military supremacy that they'll gain?
Well, in the case of the Apollo landings, it was basically the Americans weren't going to be beaten. They'd been beaten into space by Sputnik 1. They'd been beaten into with the man in space by Yuri Gagarin, and they just were not going to be beaten to the moon. And so they just pulled all stops out. No bill was too big to pay to get to the moon. Once they'd done that, they just gave up.
The actual bill was something like, what, $24,000 million, wasn't it?
Yes.
Or would that be conservative?
$24 billion in round figures. That was 1960s and 70s dollars.
Yeah, would have been heaps. It's 20 years since that event, and yet it still seems as remarkable today. What kind of interest has there been in things like your exhibition and the talks given by the Space Association?
Well, we find that the older generation look back with a certain amount of nostalgia. Each one has their own memories. Everyone knows where they were doing and what they were doing on that particular day. The younger ones often don't know much about it. They know that man has been to the moon, but they don't know the details. They know the word Apollo, but they don't know what it means. And I was speaking to a group last night, and one young lady came up to me and she said, "Thanks very much. I just had no idea what it had all been about."
Well, if you, the listener, wants to find out about Apollo, you can go along to the exhibition. The details once more, thanks, Andrew.
Yes, we're going to be open at 256 Flinders Street. That's opposite the Flinders Street Railway Station. And we'll be there from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until about 4:35 o'clock.
Any cost involved?
Yes, there will be a cost. $3 for an individual or $6 for a family group.
Thanks very much, Andrew Rennie.
Test all phone switch to arm light on.
Box bypass on.
Switching command to internal.
Box research off.
Box tank valve on.
Box tank valve on.
Fuel tank pressure 60.145.
Roger.
Injection off. Booster fuel free valve on.
Booster fuel free valve on.
Hearing log tank.
-125.
Switching telemetry to lock condition.
-120.
Status check. The man on internal.
Affirmative.
Telemetry in launch condition.
Affirmative.
Missile in internal DC.
Affirmative.
Pressurization complete.
Affirmative.
Bring her into fire.
Roadblock ready.
Roadblock ready.
Snowbox.
Ready.
Sonograph.
T-minus 60 seconds and counting.
T-minus 60 seconds and counting.
Handling to internal.
Data check.
Order full flow.
Minus
55 seconds.
Range ready.
Ready.
ASO range ready.
Minus 50.
On.
I have a
quick
command.
Ready light on.
Lock tank in security.
Reset. Minus 45 seconds. Minus 40. Status check, pressurization, go. Box tanking, go. Water systems, go. Range operations, clear to launch. Azusa, minus 30. Go. Mercury capsule, go.
You're listening to Hardly News, and the time is 9:30, and today the rocket, or rather the moon show, I guess, it's the 20th anniversary of the landing on the moon. Well, last month, the federal government approved a plan to build a spaceport at Temple Bay on the eastern tip of Cape York in Queensland. The group building the port is the Cape York Space Agency, and it's made up of an Australian company called Essington, a US company, and seven Japanese firms. And they hope to be building the port by 1992, or have built it by 1992. The initial cost they're estimating will be about $350 million, and the consortium expects to be able to launch commercially viable payloads by that time. But the news of the project hasn't received generalised applause. But here in the studio again is Andrew Rennie from the Space Association, and he's also the editor of the Space Association News, and also Mark Blair, the rocket builder. And I just want to ask him a few questions about this. When they talk about commercially viable payloads, Mark, what do they mean?
They're normally talking about commercial sector satellites, communication satellites, scientific satellites, actual satellites that go up and actually make money for the producers of the satellites themselves.
So when these firms are talking about commercially viable payloads, these satellites are up there for what purpose? I mean, it will be, I understand, the world's first commercial spaceport if it all goes ahead.
Yep, well, the fully commercial spaceport means it's not being funded by any government funding. It's completely owned by companies, individual private companies, and run by them. Every other world spaceport currently is subsidised by government. This will be the first time the world's ever seen a completely commercial spaceport.
So, the satellites, well, presume they're up there to launch satellites, I guess.
Yeah, and primarily communication satellites for TV, radio, telephone, etc. Basic communications lines.
Right. Well, I know that there were another group of companies actually bidding also for this. What happened there? I mean, I understand Bond Corporation was involved in this other bid.
Yeah, the Australian Spaceport Group was the other group involved, the other consortia. That consisted of Bond, BHP, Martin Marietta, OSAT and Comelco. And their plan
was... So it was much more Australian, in fact, in nature than the one at the moment.
Yeah, Cape York Space Agency has a international consortia, groups from all over the world. Australian Spaceport Group was mainly Australian, with the American company Martin Marietta. Their proposal was to use old intercontinental ballistic missile Titan II rockets and get them at the bargain basement prices from the States, as they're being pulled out of their silos now, and use them to launch the satellites into orbit. But it became apparent that the United States Air Force grabbed all these Titan II rockets before the Australian Spaceport Group could get hold of them. So that put a damper on their plans.
So the US side of it sort of collapsed, and therefore the Australian...
Yeah, they found that the viability of the commercial project was tenuous, as they put it, and so they withdrew from the race.
Well, I understand that the consortium that's now got it is in fact using Soviet rockets rather than US ones. I understand that the Soviets used to have actually quite a bad reputation as far as rocketry went, didn't it? Fairly sort of clunky and old-fashioned, or was that sort of the US propaganda perhaps that we got fed about rockets? Andrew might actually know a bit more about that.
Well, to some extent that was true, but it was largely propaganda and ignorance, really. For a long time, the Soviets weren't too forthcoming on the technical details of their rocketry. However, the rocket that's on offer at the moment is the Proton booster. It was first used in the late 1960s and into the 70s. It's gone through a number of design modifications and uprating, and now is a fairly reliable booster, and stands on a par with most of the Western boosters as far as reliability goes.
So you don't actually need something fantastically flash to get these things into space?
No,
apparently.
In fact, the Soviet Union, as its standard launch vehicle, still uses the same launcher that they used in 1957 to launch Sputnik 1.
Well, presuming they get these machines up there, a lot of people are actually quite concerned about some of the problems they see with a spaceport going ahead up there. People say that, in fact, it's going to contribute enormously to the greenhouse effect, apparently, with all this, the fuel being burnt with a massive output of carbon dioxide and water, say, from the burning of the fuel. What do you say to those sort of things?
Well, if you compare the... say 1,000 tons of fuel burnt in launching a rocket with the hundreds of thousands of litres of fuel burnt by Melbourne motorists driving around on their way to work this morning. I think if we stopped Melbourne motorists driving for a day or two, we would do as much for the greenhouse effect as banning rocket launches for 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, I guess people don't like to think they're actually sort of contributing a bit more to this, but it's been interesting the reaction of the government to all this. I mean, the Queensland government immediately backed the proposal, but the federal government, I think, didn't seem to be quite as enthusiastic as the Queensland government. And will we be expected to pay out for this project?
Well, the aim is to do it commercially. Now, in the sense that you contribute to some of the companies involved in the thing, yes, you'll be paying out. But the announced intention is not to call on government funding, not to call on the taxpayers' funding. Now, whether or not that actually transpires is another matter.
How confident are you that that won't happen?
Well, no other spaceport in the world has been built without government funding. And in America, for example, the operations, if you launch a satellite from any of the United States spaceports, you are being subsidized to an enormous degree by the US government. If you launch from Kourou in French Guiana, you're being subsidized by the European Space Agency, which is funded by the European governments. So no matter where you launch from, you're being subsidized.
Well, Temple Bay on Cape York's a pretty remote spot. Why there?
For a number of reasons. One, it is remote. You can't sort of build a spaceport in the middle of Melbourne or Victoria, because you've got to have a clear range, downrange, to drop the boosters as you go into orbit. And so by placing it on Cape York, you've got a clear range all the way across the Pacific Ocean. The next stop is South America, and by that time anything's dropped down or has got into orbit. Another reason for being up there is you do need a certain amount of land around the spaceport itself. This is in case the rocket veers off course and needs to be detonated and debris falls down. So you need several hundred kilometres, several hundred square kilometres around you as a safety area. And so again, there aren't many remote areas that have a clear downrange.
A very large piece of land that we're talking about for this rocket range. Plus, I guess they'll have to have some sort of infrastructure there, because a town of some sort will have to go up. Yes. So it's actually a fairly massive undertaking, isn't it?
Not really. See, the actual base that's needed isn't all that large. You need several concrete launch pads, you need several support buildings. What you need around that area is a large area that's clear of human habitation. Now, in the case of, say, Cape Canaveral, you have got a wildlife refuge area surrounding that spaceport. Now, a spaceport in or adjacent to a national park, in fact, makes a certain amount of sense, because it means that you've got a totally prohibited zone that people aren't allowed into, and that protects the environment.
I might add that that has also led to support coming from the Greenie movement in terms of from environmentalists. Mm. In terms of this land being set aside on Cape York, it's met with approval.
Approval by whom?
The
Queensland government.
The environmental. The environmental movement, in terms of protecting Cape York, turning it into a national park, the buffer zone for the spaceport will lead to protected species up there.
Yeah, I understand there's actually been no sort of environmental statement as such made yet, but it's certainly been approved by government up there. But I guess that remains to be seen whether it's as safe as they say it is. Well, when these rockets are up there, who will they be benefiting? Once the satellites are actually launched and going by 1992, do we have any idea who they'll be serving? Will Australians be able to take advantage of the fact that these rockets are launched from, or the satellites are going to be launched from Australian soil? Do we know that yet?
Well, the advantage from the point of view of operating a spaceport is that a certain amount of job generation will go on. You need quite a large infrastructure. It will also be a stimulus to Australian industry to get involved more into high technology projects. In the terms of those who actually own the satellites, obviously the shareholders benefit, because these satellites do make a lot of money, especially the communication satellites. And in terms of the general person, well, it means that a computer link overseas or a telephone call home to mum is that much cheaper.
Mm. Well, I'll just ask another few questions. The environment one's one that has troubled a number of people. You were saying earlier that when the rockets go up, there'll be debris falling from these rockets, and that you need quite a bit of space that's not inhabited around those sites so that these things can fall safely to Earth. Well, if we presume that there isn't habitation down there, which we don't really know for sure, I guess, just yet, what about the possibilities of things like fires on forest and so forth when these rockets go up and, say, flaming debris does fall to Earth? What guarantees do we have there? Does that happen? Is there a good possibility of, say, forest fires with those sorts of things happening?
Well, whenever a stage is jettisoned, it has no propellant left inside it, and in most cases it's done over the sea. It's on the, as it mentions, it's on the eastern coast of Cape York. It'll be launching out over the ocean.
Does that mean all the debris will be falling over the Barrier Reef? It is probably a good possibility, I mean, over time, I guess, that
there is a possibility, yes, that it could land on the reef. It would then just add to the shipwreck. Instead of shipwrecks, you now get space wrecks on the reef and make
another tourist industry,
another tourist attractions, yes. But so, the possibility of great damage for a booster stage falling in the ocean is not great.
Well, it looks like it's something that we'll have to keep an eye on, and I guess that sort of leads into our next discussion a bit later on in the program about space debris. I mean, all this stuff falling falling onto Earth, but actually staying in orbit out there in space, and we'll be coming to talk about that just a bit later in the program.
I want to know where the money comes from. Well, I need to know where the money comes from. Hey there, people, it comes from you. Yeah, we know it and you know it too. This is what you have to do.
Silent lines all the way. Read the back of the pack, you say. Right, you go for it.
It's your money.
Yeah, money, okay.
$5, not much to show. 20 or 5, if that ain't low. So come on, people, and get in. Go on, subscribe, that's how you begin. Supporting this community radio. 3CR, well, don't you know?
Okay, we're tracking here real cool. I reckon we can get lots of money for this.
Yeah,
you
know. Give us that money, yeah.
Those memories.
love holding you close to my breast. And I pray that you'll always love me till you go to heaven to rest.
Was Shirley Tom,
one of your favourites, Margot.
Yeah, I know. There's a few more favourites coming up, let me tell you. We've got Lassie going to the moon soon.
I haven't heard Lassie going to the moon for such a long time.
No, it'll be a joy. It's 9:45, and I tell you what, going through these old cuttings was pretty interesting. As I said before, I have the age from 1969 on the 21st, exactly 20 years ago, and for all our talk about rockets and all of that, there's some really interesting articles in here. I notice this one, The Next Target, A Man on Mars by 1982. And
missed that one.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting little article, because it was the same man that had the... he was talking about... he equated the event to... what was it? To crawling out of the, what is it?
The primeval slime.
Primeval slime, yeah. Mars will be the next major US celestial goal, Vice President Spiro Agnew said last week, and Dr. Wernher von Braun, long pressing for this new objective, claims...
None of these men have great reputations, do they? I mean...
Spiro went the way of all flesh, and what happened to Ted Kennedy, and then... So... we seem to have a problem here with our mics, but we'll go on. But, can you hear me now? How's this microphone?
I think I can hear you now.
Mars is going to be... was supposed to be the next goal, and they were aiming to get there by 1982.
Well, it was pretty interesting to look through all that and find Neil Armstrong's little tiny baby face. And I think it was very interesting to see Ted Kennedy's tiny paragraph about Mary Jo Kopechne. But just talking about the rocket launches has been pretty enlightening, Margot. It seems that although the government's very keen to go ahead with some of this, it's actually still fraught with a great many problems that have to be thought through. The idea of building perhaps on Aboriginal land and having space debris rocket down into the Great Barrier Reef and destroying more natural habitat is something that will have to be really thought out and thought through.
It is an interesting concept. Can you hear me?
No, I can't actually hear you at the moment. I think we have a slight problem. And I
how about that one?
And
that
I think we might actually go to a record very shortly.
The space race. Rockets. Missiles. Blast off. Throbbing, searing engine thrust. The masculine manifestation of a fundamentally male concept. Ever since women were little, we've heard about the man in the moon, about man in space, penetrating the outer reaches of the galaxy. Male ideologies dominate our relationship with outer space. Don't participate in this phallocentric fallacy. Support me, John Gull Armstrong, in my quest to be the first separatist on the moon. Your contribution will help set up the Women's Academy of Astrophysics. Wah! Send donations to me, John Gull Armstrong, care of Hardly News, 21 Smith Street, Collingwood. Put a separatist on the moon and reclaim the stars.
listening here to Lunar Muse on Hardly News this morning on our moon show. And although they've been putting men on the moon and sending rockets up in space, our speaker cut out, which was all a bit disturbing earlier. However, we can now all hear ourselves speak, which is just great. And in the studio at the moment, we have Lewin Dunan, who's been looking at some of the other aspects of the moon, I guess, the mythical and religious aspects. Let's hear about your investigations, Lewin.
Well, just briefly in relation to, you know, the concept of men in the moon, I wanted to say something about a T-shirt I saw in a woman out at uni where I am at the moment, which I thought was rather appropriate. And it said, if they can send one man to the moon, why don't they send them all there? I think that's rather great. If they're going to claim the moon for mankind, why don't they go there and maybe we can heal the Earth a little bit better without them? But I just want to start off with a poem. That so I want to look at the poetic and mythological, as you say, the religious aspects of the moon, which is something that technology, I think, is very fearful of, and the technological mind. Now, this one was written in 1839 by an undergraduate of Worcester College in England.